Internet. Welcome to episode 96 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my absolutely lovely hostess, Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
So today on Facebook, someone posted an article about Nancy Pelosi, and she was griping about Trump. And I actually had a moment of, oh, thank God, what a refreshing change. I don't have to hear about COVID.
or COVID-19, as my daughter says. I don't think she said it in the last segment that she was in. I think she said it correctly, but she has been arguing with my wife, who's in the pharmaceutical industry, about the proper name of this virus. And that was even after I looked it up, because I didn't know what the origin of that name was, and the fact that what is it all supposed to be all capitalized? And it is. It's coronavirus disease 2019. Mm-hmm. is what that means for any of you that didn't know and don't have the hankering to always go on Wikipedia every 5 seconds like I do. Have 27 Wikipedia tabs open on my browser. I'll get to bed sometime.
Yeah, that's known as a wiki wander.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I get deep sometimes. When you start researching the top speed of a Los Angeles class submarine and end up reading an article on Oscar Wilde, you know you're in deep.
Wow.
I don't know if that's exactly true, but you know what? It's also not exactly untrue.
So, speaking of things that are true and aren't true, we've got a couple of topics to tackle.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just dive into them. And top of the list here, you've got some idiocy in Massachusetts, but I repeat myself, about gun shops and gun ranges.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm going to guess that they have been declared non-essential, that they were closed down, which is interesting because sometime last week, the federal government declared that gun stores were essential. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so idiocy in Massachusetts, and Mara Healey is at the helm of it.
This is my shocked face.
I know. Mara, you're just so good at it. This is on her Twitter feed, or this is actually the Mass Attorney General Twitter feed. Quote, gun shops and shooting ranges are not essential businesses during a public health emergency. We cannot undermine the safety of our police officers, first responders, and domestic violence victims. And so, yes, so all the I don't know if it was an order that gone through. My gun range has been closed for a little while now. I don't know if there was a direct advisory that they got wind of before everybody else did. It was before I heard about this. And I wouldn't know about gun shops because I heard they were crowded. I've got lots of guns and lots of ammo. I don't feel like paying inflated prices for stuff. So, I'll stay right here. So, yeah, there's this idiocy going on. We'll see what's going on. Maybe the Gun Owners Action League will file a second lawsuit against Mara Healey.
What was the first one? Was that about her AR-15s are illegal unless I say they aren't, and yep. I'll let you know if you've broken the law?
Yep. The New York case is often getting talked about as the next Second Amendment case that'll be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, but the one against Mara Healey is essentially in second place as far as if the Supreme Courts don't elect to hear the case about transporting handguns through New York City, the case against Mara Healey will be the next one that they'll that'll go across the bench.
Well, I have heard that NYSERPA versus NYC is going to be mooted, and I hope it's not. But if it is, then her getting her hopefully getting her comeuppance would be worth that.
Well, I mean, essentially, it's going to the Massachusetts Supreme Court case that this is being appealed up to the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially said at the base of it, an AR-15 is not a weapon recognized by the Second Amendment. I actually don't have the reading in front of me, but you could look it up. But yeah, essentially just saying, yeah, no, AR-15s don't count. And it's one of those, there's pretty good precedence on that. So I think it would be a fairly open and shut case as far as Supreme Court cases go.
Hmm.
Speaking of other other idiocies. I spoke last week about how the fact that our parents were nice enough to offer to take my daughter for half of this quarantine, since essentially she's doing most of her classes online, so do online anywhere. And my wife said, yeah, no, I don't want to do that, just in case they shut the borders down. They haven't quite gone that far, but the state of Maine is definitely speaking out against people from out of state coming into the state and demanding people self-quarantine. That leads me to a story that's actually making the rounds pretty heavily right now. Actually, this guy was on the news just before we recorded this. Franklin County, Maine, which, oh, Jesus, that's towards the middle of the state. Franklin County Sheriff Scott Nichols issued a statement that said, we will not be setting up a police state in Maine, period. The sheriff's office will not purposely go and stop vehicles because they are on the road to ask if people are out and about. To do so puts our officer at risk. This is not Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, where you are asked for your papers. He clarified this even further on the in the interview I heard on the news, essentially stating that first up, he is a sworn peace officer, so the Fourth Amendment means a lot to him, and so the idea of just pulling over somebody because they didn't look busy enough or didn't look essential enough just to check to make sure that they were essential went against his personal beliefs. But also, he doesn't want to start throwing people in his jail, because if he gets one person with COVID-19, he is going to be screwed, because his jail's not that big. So it's one of those situations where, you know what, I appreciate what he's doing, but I don't think everybody in Maine is going that way. So unfortunately, I'm very glad that my daughter is here in Massachusetts right now. I wish it wasn't the case. I wish she could be wherever she wanted to be right now, or wherever my parents wanted her to be. So yeah, we'll stick to speaking to the grandparents over Zoom and Apple FaceTime.
So since we're on the subject of COVID-19, there's a story that's been making the rounds, and it's on Medium, and it's about what everyone's getting wrong about the toilet paper shortage. Have you seen this, Weird?
I have seen this one. It was actually super interesting.
Well, so I'm sure that you can weigh in on this in greater detail, because you think it's super interesting.
But yeah, no, this was super interesting, because again, this was interesting to me because the toilet paper disappeared, and I got to say, I think it's not quite as simple as this author says. I think there's some of the hoarding and some of the, because people are buying toilet paper, people are buying more toilet paper. I certainly bought toilet paper when I didn't need any, when I was at the grocery store. Not a lot. I just bought an extra pack, but it was something I wouldn't have done, except for I realized that toilet paper was looking a little light. This was back when there was toilet paper. So I bought an extra pack because, you know what? Goodness knows what's going to happen. And, you know, I'm glad I did. But what they're saying is one of the big issues is that, number one, toilet paper is super duper bulky. So it's not like it moves very easy or you can transport a lot of it. But also they're saying that, well, right now the office buildings of the world are more or less empty. And so they've probably got pallets upon pallets of that horrible stuff that they call toilet paper that you wipe your butt when you poop at work, which, is the only smart thing to do, especially if you work by the hour. But these massive rolls that go in those big office dispensers are completely different. They're made in different factories. They're made by different units. And it's not like they could suddenly say, oh, there's not a lot of people buying office toilet paper right now, so let's just switch over and make Charmin. They're two different infrastructures. They're two different things. So now there's a higher demand on the regular toilet paper, not because coronavirus has any gastrointestinal issues. I've read few things, but overall it's all respiratory. You're not going to, if you've got the runs, congratulations, you don't have the beer flu. And so it's not like you're suddenly going to need roll after roll of toilet paper if you get sick. It's actually just the system was never designed to handle a massive switch where suddenly people weren't pooping at work and were all pooping at home all at the same time.
Boss makes a dollar, I make a dime. That's why I poop on company time.
I heard somebody say that they made there was a calculator you could download to your phone, and you could put in your hourly rate and time your crap and figure out how much that turd was worth. But yeah, when I read this, I'm wondering how long it's going to be before someone just invents some cheap at home, like one of those little freestanding toilet paper holders that'll hold one of the mega rolls, and like figuring out ways to like dump the pallets that they've got in there in the office loading docks of toilet paper, just so people can get some butt wipe. But yeah, it was interesting to see, and I liked to see an article that wasn't blaming everything on preppers. Because that seems to be where the news was going at first. Preppers and just general idiocy, because, you know, it's one of those like, oh, there's no gastro-intestinal effects. What are people going to think they need the toilet paper for? And it's one of those, well, some of it is they think that they're worried that they're not going to see any more of it, which, hey, look, we're not seeing any more of this. My wife actually found some online and got ordered. Just like when that case of toilet paper showed up on the front door, I'm like, oh, quick, grab it. Get it in. Form a perimeter.
All right. Now for something that is a little lighter, but we're still talking about the beer flu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So weird.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you know about Magic the Gathering, because you mentioned you were a Fungusaur and you gained strength from being poked, which is why I enjoy, it's why you enjoy me abusing you, and because you enjoy it, I enjoy it. And the thing is, though, you really aren't that into it, because I've brought cards along with me to GRPC and to NRA convention, and you haven't played with me.
Well, honestly speaking, you didn't pull them out. I knew they were there, and I didn't ask for them, because I am a recovering Magic the Gathering addict. I had a serious problem back in the 90s. And so, but at the same time, if your cards came out, I'm definitely gonna fondle them a little bit, and I'm definitely gonna argue that that after Fallen Empires, it just wasn't the same.
Okay. So, obviously, they are still making new expansions,
mm-hmm.
and I'm into it, but I'm not super into it, because Magic the Gathering is crack cocaine in card formation, and there are things that I need to spend my money on, but they announced the new expansion, and they actually announced it, well, the article I'm reading was April the 2nd. Now, they made the announcement beforehand, but I didn't pay attention. But the one you linked was April the 2nd. And so I had to look at it really hard, because it kind of seemed like an April Fool's mm-hmm. article to me. But I verified it was on different sources. And so this new expansion that's coming out is called Ikoria, Lair of Behemoths. Okay. And apparently, in these boosters, they're having monsters from the Godzilla Pantheon. Okay, that's pretty cool. For those curious, Godzilla King of the Monsters is a red-green card. One red, one green, three colorless. It is a 7/3 dinosaur with trample. And lethal damage dealt to creatures you control is determined by their power rather than their toughness. I realize for most people, they aren't going to know what I said or really care, but for the few nerds out there who play Magic, hi, Xander, they'd be interested in that sort of thing. And so this announcement, well, it has to do with the beer flu, because one of the monsters is Space Godzilla. Space Godzilla is a black creature, by the way. Six colorless, two black. It's an 8/8 creature with Death Touch and Cycling. And it doesn't just say Space Godzilla. It says Space Godzilla, comma, Death Corona. And this was, of course, well before COVID-19. And it actually fits the mythology, because, oh, I'm not super into Godzilla, but I do believe that Space Godzilla has an attack called the Corona Beam.
That is correct. I am not a kaiju guy myself. I like my I'm very racist, and I like my my trashy sci-fi movies to be either American or possibly Italian. I don't know why that is, but the kaiju movies never really did it for me. But I did look it up on the. Of course, Godzilla has its own Wikipedia. I love that everything has its own Wikipedia, and. Indeed. I first up looked up regular Godzilla, and yeah, it's just called the Atomic Breath. But the Space Godzilla does have a breath weapon called the Corona Beam. And so, yeah, calling it Death Corona makes absolutely perfect sense.
Right. And then COVID-19, and it's a coronavirus, and people are dying. And, well, so let me explain something about myself so that you understand my reaction. I deal with bad news with humor. It probably partially comes from my military upbringing, where you've got the gallows humor because you laugh so that you don't cry or puke or eat a gun. And so I'm the kind of person who even now finds the songs where they're remaking My Sharona into My Corona, mm-hmm. or... Well, did you know that COVID-19 rhymes perfectly with Come On, Eileen?
Oh, yes, I did.
COVID-19, don't you know what I mean?
I've sung it.
And so now every time I see that, I hear that in my head. And I realize this is insensitive to some people, so I don't do it around them. But that's just where my brain goes. And so, you know, I see humor in a lot of this. And so I look at this and I go... You know, it was an innocent mistake. I mean, really, it wasn't a mistake, because when they did it, it wasn't an issue. They planned these things like months or maybe even a year in advance, mm-hmm. and they've got to set up the presses and things like that. And so it's not their fault, but they felt that they needed to make an announcement where they apologized for this. They apologized as if it was their fault, and it's not. And then they announced they are going to recall those cards, and then they're going to replace those cards. It's exactly the same card, except that it's going to be titled Space Godzilla, Void Invader. And because of my sense of humor, I'm not the one to tell you whether or not this is the right thing to do or not. I mean, personally, I just go, bad timing. But maybe there's someone who's more skilled in public relations, or maybe even has more empathy than I do, who would say, yes, this is absolutely the right thing to do. We don't want to appear insensitive. But the one thing I will tell you is that they aren't going to be able to recall all of them.
Mm-hmm. Your mind is going to the exact same place because you play magic.
Yes. And, well, when I was young, I collected stamps. And so there's going to be a handful that make it through, and those are going to be super duper fantastically rare, and people, not now of course, but in years to come, will pay a lot of money for that. Mm-hmm. So I mean I don't really have a point to make with this. It's just, oh hey, the beer flu is now affecting geekery too, huh? Yeah. What do you make of all this, Weird?
Well, that's exactly it. I think it's super dumb, because again, they've got the rights to the Godzilla franchise, so it's not like Fungusaur or the Lord of the Pit or some of the other monsters that are just made up. They exclusively exist within Magic the Gathering. Or even, technically speaking, Magic the Gathering's, Wizards of the Coast owns D&D. So in theory, they could put D&D monsters in that without having to dive on too much intellectual property.
And I'm surprised they haven't, actually. When I found out that Wizards of the Coast was buying D&D, I could have sworn we would have had crossovers. We would have had Banalish heroes appearing in D&D, and we would have had D&D things like Tiamat appearing in Magic. And I'm frankly shocked that in the 20 years, that hasn't happened. Wow.
And then, oh shoot, what's that big Forgotten Realms monster from D&D?
Oh, the Tarrasque.
Yeah, the Tarrasque, yeah. The Tarrasque. I don't know what the right way to pronounce it.
I don't know what the right way
is. I don't think anybody's
either.
Ever actually said it. It's all just whatever your nerdy group wants. But yeah, a Tarrasque Magic the Gathering card would be
Tarrasque.
So awesome. Yeah, I think we definitely made one just drawn on like lined notebook paper just to have one. It's probably a 10-10 trample. But yeah, they're obviously like paying to get this specific fandom in there. And when you're doing that, I mean, it's one of those, like, you don't take that lightly. You're paying money to make this card so that people that like both Magic the Gathering and Godzilla will get excited about this. And mm-hmm. So the people that have, I mean, we joke about calling it the beer flu. It's not like the crappy Mexican beer company is changing the name of their beer because it's named Corona. Corona means crown. Coronavirus has got the spiky things. It looks like a crown. It's all about crowns. And not like when, you know, if Prince Charles ends up dying of it, because he has it right now, allegedly, they're not going to change the coronation. But people are going to know it's the Corona beam. Yeah, when it's come to Space Godzilla does death by Corona. And yeah, maybe it's funny timing, gallows humor, whatever. But the idea of changing it to, I don't know if Void Invader means anything. I mean, that sounds honestly dirtier than Death Corona. I think I might have watched that movie on a closed circuit TV.
I'm gonna invade your void, weird.
Exactly. So I mean, it is dumb, but again. As you're talking about it, I suddenly started getting excited going, no, it's absolutely the right thing to do because, oh my God, those are going to be worth so much money. And just the idea of like opening up a booster pack found in like some crappy game shop that's clearly does not get enough business and just one of those, oh, there's a game shop. Let's go in. Oh, geez, they got an old set of booster pack, a box of booster packs with like dust on them. Let's buy every last one of them. Because it is crack cocaine. Just one more booster pack. I'll be fine after one more booster pack. And suddenly getting Space Godzilla, the Death Corona card, and be like, oh, I'm all set. Part of me wants to keep this and gloat it. Part of me wants to immediately put this on eBay and retire.
Yeah, I remember the stories in the early days of Magic. Someone who had... I don't remember if he had a Black Lotus or if he had a complete set of Moxen, but the idea was it was, you know, he amassed them and then was sort of getting out of the game and he sold them and bought an engagement ring for his girlfriend with the money that he got just from selling the cards.
What a waste. but yeah, no, there were some really, really valuable cards
mm-hmm.
out there. And I'm trying to remember if there's anything that was like this out there where there was like either an error printing, like the upside for stamp collecting, the upside down airplane. is there a name for that card, that stamp? I'm aware of it.
Oh, there is, but I can't remember. So let me quickly to the Googles. The Inverted Jenny.
Okay. And how much is that worth? When was the last time it went in auction?
Estimated value, $1.5 million.
Good Lord. I don't know if the Singer 1911 sold for that amount.
Number in existence, 100.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Those sort of things or the Honus Wagner, baseball card, the statement behind that being that he was a teetotaler and they were tobacco cards back in the day. And so he was like, yeah, I don't want. You know, kids to get excited about getting my baseball cards. So they're either buying tobacco for themselves or taking it from their parents or all that. So he had them pull it. So there was only a handful made. And of course that was also back in the day where nobody collected baseball cards. You had them, you collected and traded them. But when you grew up, you threw them away. So yeah, that's the one big takeaway is congratulations. Magic the Gathering is going to create its own buying glut of nerds that are addicted to this stuff, trying to get the valuable card.
So speaking of nerdery and expensive hobbies, it's said that reloading ammunition doesn't actually save you money. Rather, you just shoot more ammunition for the same cost. That said, there are some challenges which come with reloading, and David is here to teach us how to overcome them.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. The other day, I was talking with a friend about reloading. They've been considering it for a while, but haven't gotten started yet. Among the things they asked me was about common reloading issues and how they're resolved. So in this segment, I'll be discussing some of those challenges and solutions. One of the first operations performed when reloading is decapping, removing the old discharge primer to make way for a new one. This is done by use of a special die, either a universal decapping die or one that combines decapping with resizing. I use a universal decapping die as I prefer to remove the old primer before I clean my cases. In either case, this tool works by driving a steel pin through the flash hole of a Boxer primed case and pressing out the old primer. If a Berdan case gets mixed in, there's no pass-through and the pin will often snap. Lee's universal decapping die has an interesting feature to help prevent this damage. The decapping pin is held in the die body by a friction collet. There's enough resistance for normal operation, but if the pin meets too much back pressure, it slides up in the collet. If this happens, I can simply loosen the nut, reposition the decapping pin, tighten it down, and continue with the next case. In the event the pin does break, replacements are available. I try to keep one or two in my reloading supplies just in case. After being deprimed and cleaned, military cases require an additional step. One of the requirements for military cartridges is that primers won't back out during fully automatic fire. Not something most of us are concerned with. To cover this requirement, after the primer is seated, a crimp is applied around the primer pocket. This keeps the primer in place much more securely, but also causes difficulties when repriming, so the crimp has to be removed. This isn't difficult, and depending on the volume of cases to be reloaded, has two general options. For high-volume reloaders, there are bench-mounted primer pocket swaging tools. For smaller volumes, there are others which attach to the press. In use, they both perform the same operation. By using precisely sized hardened steel swaging heads, they work by applying pressure to reform the primer pocket to standard dimensions. Another issue that can occur is the case getting stuck in the sizing die. The usual cause of this is insufficient case lube. One of the reasons I prefer carbide reloading dies is they require much less lube. Even so, and especially with rifle cases, you never want to go in dry. If a case gets stuck in the die, it usually tears the rim off the case when the ram is lowered. With straight wall cases, you can usually remove the decapping pin from the top of the die and then use a punch to drive the stuck case out. Never hammer on the decapping pin. It'll almost certainly break. If removing the decapping pin is not possible, there are several stuck case removal kits available. The most common style requires drilling out the primer pocket, threading the hole, all the while being careful not to hit the depriming pin, and then using the stuck case remover body and a bolt to draw the case out of the die. Warning! Never, ever, ever use this method with a primed case or loaded ammunition. The best result would be a ruined reloading die. Speaking of case lube, there are a number of options on the market with different pros and cons. My personal preference is lanolin-based solid lubes, such as Hornady's Unique Case Lube. I smear a slight amount of lube on the neck of every 3 to 5 cases with my fingers. Whichever method of case lubing is used, the cases will need to be cleaned before proceeding with the reloading process. Case prep does involve a number of steps. One that applies almost entirely to rifle cases is trimming. As bottleneck cases are fired, the brass flows forward under pressure. This tends to lengthen the neck at the same time it thins the brass near the base. After being reloaded enough times, the brass can break at this thin point. This is called a case head separation. Long before that occurs, the case will need to be trimmed. Again, there are a number of options. I like the Lee trimmer that uses a generic cutter and lock stud combined with a case length gauge and a holder. This system fits nicely in my drill press, allowing for quick and easy batch processing. Once the cases have been trimmed to length, the cut end needs to be chamfered to smooth out any burrs left by the cutter. I use a traditional RCBS deburring hand tool. One end chamfers the outside of the case mouth, and the other the inside. There are some tools that claim to do both at the same time, but I haven't had much luck with them. One of the most critical operations when reloading is precise measurement of powder. With precision loads, a variation of a tenth of a grain can make a significant difference. Obviously, I checked my powder drop setting with a scale, but how do I know the scale is accurate? This is where scale check weights come in. These are very precise weights that are used to confirm the scale is reading accurately. Because of the precision, these weights are not cheap, but still much less expensive than a damaged firearm or injured shooter. Finally, what can be done if a cartridge was loaded improperly and it needs to be disassembled? There are two general options, impact or collet bullet pullers. As the name implies, impact bullet pullers use the mass of the bullet to draw it out of the case. In use, a cartridge is put in one end of the head, which is then struck against a hard surface. The bullet, being greater mass, lags behind when the head bounces. It may take several blows to get the bullet out, but all the components are salvageable. This style works with nearly all types of bullet, including wad cutters. Collet-style bullet pullers are seated in the press, and a caliber-specific collet is tightened around the bullet. The leverage of the press is then used to pull the case down off the bullet. While this technique is generally faster, the collet can cause damage to the bullet, especially cast bullets. Collets can't be used with wad cutters, as there isn't enough bullet protruding from the case for them to grab. There are, of course, other challenges during reloading, but hopefully this segment has set the expectation that for every problem, there is a solution, and it doesn't always have to be an expensive one.
You should put my links in the show notes, Weird. My cousin didn't put my links in the show notes once. Once.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Yeah, Aaron, you don't reload, do you?
No, I don't. I don't have the space for it. Mm-hmm. Among other things, and yeah, it's a thing that I would like to do, at least intellectually I would like to do, but I look at, I don't really have the time, I don't have the space, I definitely don't have the money for it right now. That's for when I'm older, for yeah. Maybe when I retire.
Intellectually, you can get into it pretty cheap with, like, there's a thing called the Lee Anniversary Kit, and it's like $110 thereabouts, like right now. I think I paid like $80 for mine, and it's just a single stage press, and you get one set of dies with it, and you can essentially do just about everything, not necessarily glamorously, not necessarily quickly, but you can get it all done. Add a few extra things in there, like probably under $150, definitely under $200. You are not including, the components. You can make your own cartridges. So it's one of those things that you could do it with not a lot of space and not a ton of scratch. But again, if you get serious into it, it's kind of like Magic the Gathering. Like, there's always a little bit more that you can spend to get something a little bit nicer. Oh, I could get a little bit nicer scale. Oh, I could get a progressive press. Ooh, I could get one of the automated presses, and then I'm just working. I'm just, you know, just fill up the hopper and just go have lunch.
Yeah, that's when you start getting the catalog from Dylan Press or Blue Press by Dylan, and yep, you start thumbing through that like it's a Playboy. Just, ooh.
Literally, my gunsmith actually has in the back of his shop. This is Greg Durr of Durr Precision. If you've heard of him, he does excellent work. I couldn't recommend him more. He literally has like six Lee progressive presses in the back of his shop, and he's just got them set up for each caliber that he shoots. I'm like, life's too short to change dies. I just bought a whole new press.
Wow.
I mean, he's a serious competition shooter too, so it's one of those like, I can't blame you.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, if you've got the lifestyle that supports it, and definitely if you have the money, God bless, go for it.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's one of those things of the, yeah, you could get real, real nerdy with hand loading. It all depends on how you go. And yeah, and he said it before, and actually we just did a bit on this on Handgun Radio, so which will probably be coming out there about the same time as this one. But one of the things I can't recommend more is those kinetic bullet pullers, because there's some level of cheapness that is involved with someone who's hand loading their own ammunition. You are definitely figuring out how you can get the best bang for your buck with the ammunition, because otherwise you wouldn't be going to all this trouble for essentially what you could just buy off the shelf at your local gun shop. And so, though currently now with the gun shops either closed or sold out, now making your own at home suddenly becomes a lot more tempting. But I like the kinetic bullet puller, because the idea that you can have either a single round or possibly a batch of rounds. I had one where I actually pulled 5 consecutive bullets because I knew one of those 5 did not get its powder charge in. And to be able to pull all of those and just know that I can just reload them and I'm not throwing anything away, such as a damaged bullet, really makes you much more willing to just say, ugh, I'll just do it.
So, why didn't you weigh them?
Number one, my scale isn't that good. And, and number two, the weight of the bullet, these are 45 ACPs and it was 5 grains of powder was the difference. Like I don't think it was, I think the 45 ACP just in itself, a 230 grain bullet seated in a casing was maxing out my scale.
Okay. All right. That's fair. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was, well, weigh them, and the one that weighs more or less than the others is the one that has the problem.
Yeah,
but
the good news was it was essentially I was weighing every 5th charge just to make sure that my charges were coming out just right, and so I went to go weigh the another charge and went to go dump the charge in the scale and realized the scale was already full with a perfectly weighed charge and went, well, one of these guys was meant to have this one. And so luckily I knew that there was no more than 5. I think it was 4 rounds before I was going to get to the one that was empty. So carrying on further to utter geekery, but this is a different kind of geekery. Geeks come in both sides, and there also are anti-gun geeks. And there were a pair of geeks who ran Armed with Reason, and Armed with Reason is essentially no more. And now there is a group called GVpedia, and let's just say they're putting out videos and they are ripe for audio fisks. For those who have followed the Gunblog Variety Cast or my blog, you might have heard of Evan DeFilippis and Devin Hughes, who ran an anti-gun blog called Armed with Reason. Their goal was to produce science-based arguments for gun control. The niche they wanted to fill was so needed that Michael Bloomberg made them regular contributors to his personal anti-gun news site, The Trace. Of course, Evan had a background in economics, and Devin has a background in finance and risk management, not the hard sciences. This means their strength is in statistical analysis, not the scientific method. Coupled with their unbreakable devotion to the cult of gun control, meant their studies were really just examples of confirmation bias or simply ignoring the results of studies that showed results they didn't agree with. But I'm telling you all this because really their work peaked in 2016, and the pair essentially broke up when Evan packed up and went to Harvard to pursue his PhD in psychology, and probably to meet one of his heroes, Dr. David Hemingway, whose own ham-handed gun control studies led to the creation of the Dickey Amendment. Devin decided to continue the quest started with Armed with Reason with what is essentially an encyclopedia of gun control and lesson plans for anti-gun college professors. He calls this collection the GVpedia. They have started producing YouTube videos, likely as lesson material for college classes, and today's fisk will be on their claim that defensive gun use is a myth.
Early in the morning on November 2nd, 2013, Theodore Wafer heard pounding on his door. He grabbed his shotgun from the closet, went downstairs, and opened the door. When he saw a shadow behind his screen, he fired. But the shadow was a 19-year-old girl who was going to ask for help after a car accident.
Now this is a very interesting start to what is supposed to be an academic video. As we say in the sciences, anecdotes are not data. Still, since this is where Mr. Hughes decided to start, let's fill in a few details on the story. The story is about the death of Renisha McBride on November 2nd, 2013, and it happened just outside of Detroit. Ms. McBride was at a late-night party and attempted to drive home while extremely drunk. Thankfully, she crashed her car into an unoccupied parked car. She then wandered the streets for 3 hours in what witnesses say was a delirious state. Around a quarter to five in the morning, Ms. McBride began violently banging on Theodore Wafer's front door, and did so hard enough to cause noticeable damage to the door. Mr. Wafer was sleeping in a chair in his living room and didn't remember where he left his cell phone, so he retrieved a shotgun and went to the door. By this time, his porch was empty, so he opened the door and was noting the damage to his storm door when Miss McBride came around the corner of the house, startling him. This was when he shot and killed her. There are a lot of details GVpedia left out of this anecdote. Also, what they failed to account was that Mr. Wafer was sent to prison for second-degree murder and received additional time for using a firearm in the commission of a felony. For as bad as this story was, this was not a defensive gun use. Ms. McBride was unarmed, she was physically smaller than Mr. Wafer, and she was shot through a locked storm door. To lawfully use deadly force, you must prove that the person you acted upon had both motive and opportunity to cause death or grave bodily harm to you or another innocent party. Ms. McBride may have shown motive by violently banging on the door and damaging Mr. Wafer's property, but she had no opportunity to cause harm to Mr. Wafer while there was still a locked door between them. And if Mr. Wafer had opened the door, it could be argued that the action showed that he was not in fear for his life, and that the shooting of Miss McBride was not justified. So it's an interesting start to a video because A, it's a story that's designed to invoke an emotional response, not a rational one. And B, it isn't even a defense of gun use. Mr. Wafer claimed he acted in self-defense. And in the cited notes, an Armed with Reason article claims that the Second Amendment community talking about defensive gun use is leading gun owners to believe murder can be justified. But if this is true, why is he using a story that's over 6 years old and omitting the part where Mr. Wafer is still in prison for the murder?
It is a common myth that a good guy with a gun will keep us safe from a bad guy with a gun. The idea that guns make us safer is simply false and can have a deadly impact.
Well, except for just about every instance of a bad guy with a gun is in fact ended with a good guy with a gun. Sometimes those good guys are police, sometimes they are not. To claim it's untrue is a lie. As for guns not making us safer, well, frequently when debating anti-gun people, I point out that relaxing gun laws decreases violent crime. They frequently cite Missouri as an example of repealing gun laws and an increase in violent crime. I say an example, really I should say the only example, as the repeal in Missouri's gun control laws, most of them vestiges of back when Missouri was a slave state and wanted to keep the blacks and Native Americans disarmed, is all they have. Also, it happens to be the studies, the most prominent one conducted by Dr. Daniel Webster of the Bloomberg School of Public Health, were done after the massive riots centered around Ferguson. Literally, Missouri is the exception that proves the rule. And at worst, when gun control laws are repealed, violent crime rates stay the same. Often, they get better.
In fact, studies show that having a firearm in your home doubles your risk of homicide and triples your risk of suicide.
The Kellerman study! Go into the show notes. I have a link to the Gun Blog Variety Cast where I break down why the Kellerman study is such a terrible study. It's also a very old study, as in conducted in the late 80s and early 90s. Why cite a study so old that many of the gun laws that were in effect at those times have been repealed? Especially when your argument is that gun control saves lives. It's because it was a junk study, and the results weren't able to be replicated by a researcher not willing to cherry-pick where the data was collected or how the parameters were defined.
Belief in this myth also results in laws that make us less safe, such as laws that allow people to carry a gun without a permit and stand your ground laws, which allow people to use lethal force in self-defense outside the home, even if they could have safely retreated.
Thanks to the scholarly nature of GVpedia, they actually do cite their sources. Not that these sources actually talk about constitutional carry or stand your ground laws. Simply put, when constitutional carry is enacted, violent crime rates go down. As for stand your ground laws, that's a mixed bag. There are studies that show that violent crime is reduced, others where violent crime is increased. I did see one rebuttal that criminals are claiming stand your ground as a defense to their assaults and murders. Either way, I don't support stand your ground laws because they reduce crime, but because they eliminate dangerous precedents in the law. The video says it best, when they could have safely retreated. That statement is as loaded as anything else. You don't get to plan for a deadly force encounter. The attacker is the one who determines the time and the place where you will be assaulted. As we talked about before with the murder of Renisha McBride, a deadly force scenario can be very complicated. And the key details between lawful self-defense and unlawful violence sometimes needs to be parsed in milliseconds. Adding in, what are my safe escape options, further complicates this situation where you are the victim. Just to better explain my point, I included a video of a martial arts instructor talking about how running is a very bad idea in a self-defense scenario. He essentially said, who can you think of that is a better fighter than you, but you can outrun? He focuses on hand-to-hand combat, so adding in firearms also changes this a bit. He goes on to point out, if you attempt to run and fail, you will now be in a dangerous encounter while out of breath. As I said above, justifiable self-defense requires both motive and opportunity. Opportunity means that they can do this harm to you right now. That really implies that if you could get away, it really isn't justifiable. But states with duty to retreat laws demand an affirmative defense that the person who used deadly force either attempted to get away or were justifiably incapable of doing so. Does that make any sense to you?
The gun lobby tries to prove that guns make us safer by repeating the same stories over and over again about the few cases of successful defensive gun use.
Said in a video where they lead with a nearly 7-year-old story of a man who was convicted of murder. Meanwhile, the NRA publishes a column of several cases of justifiable self-defense every month in their magazine. And you can read it online. And those are all stories that made the local papers. The studies of armed self-defense note that 90% of cases, no shots were fired. So yeah, everything said in that last clip was completely false.
But there aren't millions of instances of defensive gun use every year. In fact, there are only about 2,000 verified cases annually.
I'm perfectly willing to concede that the Gary Kleck numbers are artificially high because it relied on the recipient's honesty and memory. Maybe they said they had a defensive gun use because they thought it was a good answer or what a researcher wanted to hear. Maybe they did have a defensive gun use, but when asked if it was in the last 5 years and it was 6 or 7 years ago, they still answered in the affirmative. Still, when data shows that around 90% of all defensive gun uses end with no shots fired, the idea that the only defensive gun uses would be reported either by the press or by police seems like a bad way to collect data. Further, the only reference that they cite that even talks about defensive gun use, which is very telling as this is the very subject of the video, cites the Gun Violence Archive. First up, they note that GVA is nonpartisan. Except there, a defensive gun use is only defined as an event where somebody was injured or killed. And there is a newspaper article associated with it. So their numbers are likely wildly underreported.
Which are vastly outnumbered by the more than 39,000 firearm deaths, tens of thousands more injuries, hundreds of thousands more abusive uses, and over 200,000 more firearm thefts annually.
First up, I can't recall a single year where there were 39,000 firearms deaths. And they're using stacking numbers on top of an initial incorrect number. But they are relatively close. Still, when the CDC studied defensive gun use, their low estimate was 500,000, and they cite the 3 million number as a possibility. Again, I think 3 million is high, but likely a 500,000 is still a low estimate, and the truth is probably between those numbers. Not their 2,000 cases number, which is insane. But they need that number because the 500,000 lowball dwarves their bad statistics. Also, it says a lot that their nonpartisan source is literally orders of magnitude different from even the next lowest estimate.
44% of Americans know someone who has been shot.
These numbers include suicide, and roughly 50% of all suicides in America are by gun. This technically means if you know two people who have taken their own lives, you likely would be part of this 44%. Also, this is cumulative and doesn't require the person to be in your nuclear family or any other restrictions. I did a little tally, and unfortunately, I know 7 different people who were shot. 4 of them were suicides, Two were attempted suicides, and one was shot by his brother while they were kids out rabbit hunting in the 1980s. Not all of these people are even close friends. I actually have forgotten the names of the three people who were shot and survived, as I met them in college. Remember, GVpedia is a portmanteau of gun violence and encyclopedia. None of these acts were violent in any way, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Together, we can set the record straight. More guns do not reduce crime.
Except they do. GVpedia is literally working to keep the record from being set straight.
Join the conversation by sharing this video and spreading the word.
Now that I will do, because there's nothing more damning to a cause than showing how much effort an anti-gun group expends to simply conceal the truth. So yeah, their video's in the show notes, and I hope you all watch it. Also, you can read their notes, which allegedly support these lies. But you can also read my notes and see which ones seem better supported. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
You know, this really reminds me of that one anti-gun podcast that lasted for, I don't know, 6 episodes. And apparently, you know, like 99% of the subscribers were gun owners who were listening to it and laughing. I don't remember what it was called.
It was called Loaded Conversations.
Yes, Loaded Conversations. And this Armed With Reason reminds me of that. It's just the Wikipedia version thereof.
Yeah. They were read enough that when they were still Armed With Reason, they were on the Bloomberg payroll, at least to some level. So there was always that. But yeah, and I don't know. I would not be surprised if some of these lectures are being either played or viewed by played during college classes or viewed by college professors before they make anti-gun lesson plans. There's certainly, I've heard there's no shortage of anti-gun lessons out there. And actually, I was reading about college professors getting afraid that they might have to put their lessons plans online, and that their lessons might get out to the general population and they might get stormed by, in this case, it was speaking about specifically about right-wing people, storming them for their ultra left-wing values. But also, I got to imagine there's a lot of anti-gun stuff going around in certain college lectures.
Oh, dear. So I really don't have much to add to this, Fisk. What I have is sort of tangential yet related. So you mentioned that these folks were on the Bloomberg payroll. Mm-hmm. And, well, actually, you mentioned this in your blog. Oh, gosh, it was like a couple of weeks ago at this point. Mm-hmm. And you were surprised, and I was surprised to read it, when the anti-gun organ, The Trace, actually decided to do a post about gun safety and education, and they gave not terrible advice. You mentioned it on your blog, and the article is titled, "You Just Panic Bought a Gun, Here's How to Handle It Safely." And we were both looking at it and going, how in the hell did this get greenlit?
I know, it was hilarious, especially since they were talking. I mean, we said it before. The people that are panic buying these guns, they're not all white, elderly, boomer Republicans. There are young, urban people of color who probably didn't vote for Donald Trump, possibly voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election, and are definitely going to be voting for someone who's not Donald Trump in the next election. But you know what? They're human beings like the rest of us, and I'm very glad to have guns. I don't blame anybody else who would want to have one right now. So The Trace saw the writing on the wall and wrote to appeal to people that might be readers of Bloomberg's The Trace who might now suddenly be gun owners.
Yeah, and that's wonderful, but really unexpected. And you and I had different takes on this. And so you talked about, among other things, the bad methodology, because early on you've got the obligatory, oh, multiple studies show that having guns means you'll increase chance of dying, blah 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 blah, and then when you click on the link it takes you to cancer.gov.
exactly.
And so there's that, and there may have been other things. And so before I talk about what I want to talk about, I want to give you a chance to just hit the highlights of your article.
Yeah, essentially they start off with their usual, I mean, that's the trace. So they had to dive into into all the horrors and saying that, you know, you're a million and billion times more likely to hurt yourself with a gun. You know, if you've got a gun right now, you're better off just not having one. And they link over to a Harvard webpage that lists a bunch of studies. I ended up looking up a few of them and ended up not even talking about them in my blog. And so I actually don't have the numbers here, but a bunch of them are bad studies. And, you know, it's Harvard. So David Hemenway is the lead author on a couple of these studies. And he's, as I said in the Fisk, he's one of the reasons why we have the Dickey Amendment. He essentially created propaganda wrapped in the cloak of science, and people went, we're not paying for this with public dollars. But what's hilarious is when you end up clicking to try to get to these studies through the Harvard page, it takes you to cancer.gov. And it's one of those like, oh, did Bloomberg not check the links? Did they just say, it's Harvard, it's good enough, and move on? So yeah, the required fear-mongering is pretty thin. But I think the better point is what you focused your article on, Aaron.
Why, thank you. So, yeah, I looked at this, and I had an entirely different point of view. Now, people who are fans of mine, thank you, I love you, have noticed that I am very fond of making the point that we don't believe in abstinence-only sex education, why then do we believe in abstinence-only gun education? And Bloomberg, for the longest time, has been a proponent of abstinence-only gun education. You don't need them. Therefore, you don't need to know how to use them. So people are panic buying, and I can't really say that it is wrong of them. I mean, at the time, it kind of looked funny, but, you know, we're all gun owners. Hey, whatever drives you to get one, go ahead. But now when we're seeing that there are police departments who are out sick, how they're saying there are all these crimes we're not going to respond to. Yeah, it makes sense that people are going, you know, the police might not arrive. They might not arrive in time. I'm going to get a gun. And so there are all these people who are, yeah, let's go get one. And now Bloomberg has been put in this really awkward position. I liken him to that abstinence-only parent who has suddenly discovered that his kid is sexually active. And now he's got a choice. He can either ignore it and hope it goes away, or accept reality and seek advice from professionals. And to his credit, and I say his, I mean, he didn't write this article, obviously. He's not even the editor of The Trace, but, well, he owns it, he publishes it. He's the captain of the ship. Mm-hmm. And so, in a very real sense, whatever The Trace says, you know, he owns it. He may not have literally said it, but he figuratively has said it, because he does truly, legally own it. And so that's why I'm saying he is saying this, and there's a point to that. You know, he's faced with this choice, and he has fortunately done the sensible thing of realizing that he needs to consult an expert. The delicious thing about this, though, is that there are no anti-gun experts that he can consult. And every resource in this article is pro-gun. So by the time you hear this, it will have been released on my blogs, and I don't want to spoil this for you. I want you to read the whole thing. But the delicious part is that one of the things they do reference are the four rules of gun safety. The four rules of gun safety were invented by Colonel Jeff Cooper, who was a board member for the NRA. Now, they can't bring themselves to admit that, but they do link to a blog post which lists them, and that blog post is by Springfield Armory. Springfield Armory makes those nasty AR-15s. And so, just with this one link, Bloomberg is endorsing a manufacturer of AR-15s and saying that the advice of an NRA board member, and therefore the NRA itself, is good and proper and useful. And so I've got more of this, and I'm not going to lie, I take delight in kicking him in the balls, because this entire article is him admitting, grudgingly, maybe even he doesn't know that he's doing this, but he is admitting that gun owners are right. And it is just so delightful that someone who has hated us for decades is finally going, okay, you might have a point, and you probably are the people I should go to tell people how to use it safely. And it's just, it's, oh gosh, I giggled so hard at this. So, yeah, go to my blog. You probably have already seen it by the time this drops, but if you haven't, go to my blog, go to my Facebook page, read this. I had a blast writing this, and you can just imagine the steam coming out of Bloomberg's ears. And honestly, I have some concerns for the future career prospects of the editor-in-chief who greenlit this. I'm not sure if this person's going to have a job after this.
I'm definitely sure I don't feel bad about it.
Well, yeah. On the one hand, for all the anti-gun stuff they've done, yeah, okay. But still, it's like, this is the one good thing they've done. I don't want them punished for this.
Yeah. Well, but it's the one good thing they did in a sea of things that Bloomberg thought was perfectly acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
One good deed doesn't excuse a multitude of sins.
That's true. But just in my mind, as I was reading this article, what I envisioned was this completely hardcore Catholic parent realizing, my kid's having sex, I need to go get an expert, and so goes across the hall to the lady of questionable morals and easily purchasable love, bringing them in and talking about safe sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just imagine the, I hate every bit of this, but it's necessary. And so, I thought it was delicious, and apparently you did too, and so I hope our readers will pop on over and give it a read.
And I'd like to add one more thing that I think eluded both of us, but I kind of stepped back from it, but it occurred to me after I wrote my article. But Mike the Gun Guy Weiser frequently brags about how much he donates to Everytown for gun safety and how much he loves. He refers to our friends from Everytown and our friends from the Trace whenever he blogs about them. And he is an NRA certified trainer here in Massachusetts and vehemently anti-gun. And interestingly enough, for all that he has done to be noticed by Michael Bloomberg, he still didn't make it into the Rolodex of, hey, an anti-gunner who actually can teach some gun safety. It's just delicious because he's also a jerk.
When will Senpai ever notice me?
I mean, it's just, I mean, this article gave me great joy.
As well it should.
And what also gives me great joy is all of our listeners, each and every one of you, and especially all of our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump.
That was such a fantastic segue. In fact, I was going to try and steal it from you, but you thought of it first. Well done.
Well, thank you very much. I take a bow.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You know where to find me. I am all over the place. I'm going to take this moment to once again pimp the Operation Blazing Sword Pink Pistols March and April raffle. We've still got these great prizes. We've extended it for another month because of, you know, the coronavirus and people not, you know, it's like, well, I've got this money, but should I spend it on this or should I spend it on toilet paper? Should I hoard it? Well, we've extended it an extra month because, well, unless you are an essential employee, you're stuck at home. What are you going to do? So you might as well enter the raffle and try and get some good stuff. Look, we've got over $3,000 worth of prizes, and we've only got about 1,500 in donations. I would really like to match that, please. So if you could, please donate. The donation email is donations@blazingsword.org over PayPal. There's some great stuff, and you can't win if you don't play.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
So no, he doesn't play magic because, ooh, he's got an addiction. Oh no, I can't touch it. But he's perfectly okay with reinfecting me with it. And God, last year I spent too much money on magic cards in the hopes that I would get him to play with me. And now he won't play with me because he's too good for magic. The way we cope with our card-related addictions are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night. I'd absolutely play magic with you, Eric.